Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest episode, the latest exciting adventure from Life on Planet Porky. And of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones, is with me. Leslie Ann, how are you?
Yeah, very good, Mike. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing pretty well because just a few hours ago, my team Everton beat your team Spurs. When I say your team, the team, of course, that your uncle played for, Cliff Jones, in the double winning team of the 60s. And it was a fantastic and dramatic match at Goodison Park in which Everton eventually prevailed in extra time, winning 5-4.
Brilliant result. You must have been very pleased. I always look forward to talking to you the day after a big winning match because always on top form.
Well, absolutely. And what I did was, right, because, of course, we're all in lockdown, I tried to replicate the circumstances that I would be enjoying at a ground. So what I do is I've got a tall back chair, which replicates a sort of comfortable chair inside a comfortable box in a football ground, if you know what I mean. And what I did was, particularly because it was such a good game, because Everton were 3-1 up at half time, so we thought we were cruising, I went and got myself a glass of white wine and some French fancies, which are little cakes, okay?
I'm glad you qualified that.
Yes, exactly. Yes, family show and all that, Miss Jones. because that's what you normally get at half time in the boardroom. You see what I mean? You walk back into the boardroom, the glass of wine's waiting for you at your seat there at the table, and some little cakes or sandwiches or something like that. I couldn't be bothered to make a sandwich, so I thought I'll have a few French fancies.
Cool. Do they actually serve French fancies in the boardroom?
Well, something like that. If they're not French fancies, they're fairy cake. Oh, excuse me, or something like that. Or those other cakes I like, Bakewell tart cakes, you know what I mean?
It's all a bit suggestive, your taste in cakes, isn't it?
It's French fancies, Bakewell tart. Where do we go next? Yes.
Oh, I mean, goodness me. Yeah.
But no, what I was going to say was that I tried to do that, so then I sat there. But then it got so tense in the second half because Spurs pulled back to 3-3. I overindulged in the French fancies, which, of course, is a very dangerous thing to do if you've got diabetes too, which I've nearly beaten, but I won't be beating it if I start indulging in... I mean, they're almost pure sugar, those French fancies, you know.
Mm. Do you not have a savoury tooth in the back there somewhere?
Oh, yeah, I could have eaten bits of cheese, which they sometimes serve, but I couldn't be bothered cutting the cheese up. I've got... My favourite cheese is white crumbly Cheshire from my home county of Cheshire, and I love it. But when you cut it up, it all crumbles all over the place, so I went for the easy option.
That cheese doesn't really taste of anything.
Oh, it does. I love it. White crumbly. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've also got mature cheddar, but I find that a bit too strong, if you see what I mean.
Mm. So if I have a bland cheese like that, I tend to have to chop up the pickled onions and, you know, not have a whole pickled onion, but just a little bit. So I can't find myself chopping the pickled onions up, which is very, very time consuming, just to give it a bit of an edge, you know. Otherwise, I don't like eating bland things at all. I need strong flavours.
I know what you mean. And I usually dip it in Branston pickle. The jar of Branston pickle. And
can't get this lot down without the Branston. Do you remember that slogan?
Yeah. What was that?
Can't get this lot down without the Branston.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I totally agree. Now then, Miss Jones, do you remember we talked about a picture of Halle Berry, myself and our colleague, Mr. Roger Tavener? And I said to you, didn't I? I said, oh, and how did Mr. Tavener get on in his relationship with Halle Berry? And of course, that's all very sort of clouded in the past and all that kind of stuff. But there was an insinuation somewhere, and I'm certainly not accusing Mr. Tamler of this, that men sometimes exaggerate the extent to which their friendship has progressed with a lady. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they do it all the time. We've all had it. You know, we've all had rumours get back to us where they say, well, I never knew about you and XYZ. I said, well, what about me and XYZ? Because it's news to me. Oh, well, according to him, blah, 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 dot, dot, dot. And you think, well, actually, no, I'm fed up, not hard up. I wouldn't have touched him with yours.
Yeah. Oh, no, Miss Jones, you know, hard up and all this. What are we getting into here? Anyway, look, I'm not accusing Mr. Tavra of that. Roger didn't have to indulge in that sort of immature behaviour. But I remembered when it happened right in front of me once at my first paper, the Chester Chronicle, right? There was a guy there who was a reporter. I won't name him because it'll embarrass him. But he fancied himself very much, you know, he's a good looking, tall guy, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And he was always trying it on with what we used to call the Teliad girls, okay?
Mm.
telly-ad girls were called telly-ads because they used to sit at a desk with telephone headphone on, headset, and take adverts over the phone, right?
And they had generous balconies, most of them, didn't
they? Yes, they did. Yes, they did. I mean, it was the sort of newspaper equivalent to the secretarial typing pool, if you see what I mean. And and of course, they used the same pub as we do. And this guy I'm talking about was always, you know, kind of trying it and all that. Anyway, he was in the pub there one time and he started telling us all about a conquest he'd made on one of the telly-ad girls, okay? And he didn't realise that some of the other telly-ad girls were sitting there. So after about 10 minutes, all of a sudden the doors flung open. This girl comes storming in. I mean it, storming in. And what had happened was one of the telly-ad girls already in the pub had gone back to the office and told her that this guy was telling a tale of an alleged sexual conquest involving her and telling it in dramatic detail. And this lady stormed in, confronted him, slapped him across the face, said if she ever heard anything like that being spoken about again involving her, she would go to lawyers and she would sue him, and that he was a pathetic little runt, and that, you know, he had about as much chance of indulging in a sexual liaison with her as Noddy. And it was the most embarrassing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of women would have just cowered in the corner and gone, oh, God, that's what blokes are like, you know. Yeah. Good for her for standing up to him.
Yes. No, I was very impressed with her indeed. And, you know, she became a legend within the office. And, of course, the other
guy. And you didn't go near her ever again.
Say again.
You didn't go near her ever again.
Well, I mean, it's too dangerous. She's too formidable a woman, wasn't she? And, yeah. And the other guy, by the way, he was the one who was cowering in the corner. Whenever we were all in the pub together, it's called the Diva Hotel in the Rose in Chester, he was always round the other side of the bar from then onwards. You know, he couldn't show his face in front of the girls. But I think it is appalling when you go and, you know, try and take somebody's reputation apart. I've often sort of fancied a lady at work or something like that, you know what I mean, and never quite got there. But whenever somebody in the bar's insinuated, you know, how'd you get on there, Mike? I promise, never, ever exaggerated whatever's happened between me and a lady, because A, I think it's so disrespectful, but B, you're going to get caught out. Because, I know another bloke, it was on the Express, actually, who used to go around claiming that, you know, he had a conquest there, and then next time he got drunk, he couldn't remember who he was talking about, you know?
I had a brilliant example of something like that. A publisher I used to work with who had offices in Edinburgh. Yes. And he'd separated from his wife. I think the divorce had gone through. They always had a Christmas party. Yeah. You know, the Edinburghians like to drink, let's
yes.
say.
Yes.
And this jolly went on, lasted about 14 hours. And he said he went home realizing that he'd proposed to some girl that night.
Jolly.
But yeah. he couldn't remember who it was. And he thought, yeah. well, he consoled himself with the fact that well, she'd be bound to come into my office the next day and be enthusing about it and all the rest. So he would then find out who it was.
Yes.
So he went into the office the next morning, sat behind his desk, tinkled around with a few bits of paper and waited. Yeah. And about 20 minutes later, in burst two girls. Yeah. So he'd proposed to two girls, in fact,
what,
at the party the night before. Yes.
And sorry, had he actually intended to marry one of them?
Well, in your cups, I guess you intend to do all kinds of things, don't you?
Golly.
That you might regret the next day.
Yeah, well, yes, I suppose you do. But if he realised he had proposed, either he's a very stupid man to propose to two, or he actually had honourable intentions to one of the two women, but couldn't remember which one. What a drip.
Yeah, what a drip. But he did marry one of them, but it didn't last very long. So
oh,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sounds like a man of little character to me. Do I know this person?
No, you don't. No.
Right. Okay. Now, just on that sort of the sexuality amongst the workers, what do you think of blokes who wear ties? Do you think it improves their appearance, or do you think it looks pompous, or do you, you know, just not regard it?
I like a tie. I do right. like a man in a shirt and tie, you know, nice, clean, crisp shirt with a beautiful silk tie. It can't be a cheap one. I think it does lend something to the appearance, because a man's attire otherwise is quite sober, isn't it? It's just a suit, it's dark material. It's, you know, if you're going to wear a shirt, it's got to be a good quality one. It can't be frayed around the collar or the cuffs or anything.
I agree.
And a nice silk tie, an expensive one. You can tell. Yeah. You can tell when something's polyester and something's really silk.
Golly, of course you can, yeah. No, I totally agree with that. I good shirts I wear if I'm, you know, going somewhere where I'm wearing a tie. A good shirt would cost me about 120 quid and the tie would cost me about 60 quid, I reckon. And because I haven't been to a football ground for a year, I've not had to wear a tie. The only place I wear a tie now is if I'm going into the boardroom at a football club, because it's required dress. But for instance, if I'm making an appearance on Jeremy Vine, I don't wear a tie anymore because I feel easier without it, you know. Anyway, the reason I'm asking you all this, Ms. Jones, is listen to this. A woman writing in The Guardian says, ties are a symbol of male oppression. The necktie is one of the most politically charged items of body adornment. The necktie echoes the shape of the codpiece, a fabric flap or pouch designed 500 years ago to emphasise a European nobleman's importance through his phallic size.
Well, what a load of codswallop is what I have to say to that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for goodness sake. No, I can't see that as a phallic symbol at all. No, just because it's long and it's got a kind of lumpy bit at the top.
Well, no, it says it is arrow-shaped to direct the eye of an onlooker down towards a man's groin. So that's why
we all
like
know where it is. We don't need a map, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But that's why you like a tie, Miss Jones, is it? I see. So that you can innocently cop an eyeful.
Absolutely not. If I want to cop an eyeful, I'll direct my gaze even straight to the place in question. But no, how rude would I be to do such a thing anyway?
Yes, well, totally agree. And of course, this is a family show, Miss Jones, so we all believe you. Thousands wouldn't. Anyway, listen, getting on to a rather more serious subject, I was very saddened to hear the death of Mary Wilson. I regard her as one of the greatest singers and greatest entertainers of my lifetime.
Yeah, such a shame, wasn't it? I mean, she wasn't very old. And it's that whole Supremes, Diana Ross and the Supremes. Yep. It was a very kind of cloudy story in a way. Mm. Because they were only 17, those three girls, when they came out of the projects. And they were obviously launched by Berry Gordy and the Motown machine as America's greatest girl group, really. They were unsurpassed.
Oh, yes.
In terms of their popularity. I think, didn't even Billboard magazine name Diana Ross Female Entertainer of the Century or something?
And most beautiful woman in the world, I think.
Yeah, well, according to her, that would be the case. I went to interview her once.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, I remember addressing her as Diana after a couple of minutes, and she became very angry with me and stood up and insisted that I call her Miss Ross for the rest of the interview.
Good God. That's shocking, isn't it? And I saw her once at, I think we mentioned Radio City in our last podcast for some reason. I can't remember why. And I saw her with my colleague Philip Finn and a couple of other people at Radio City in New York. And I mean, you know, the glamour factor is devastating. You know, all her backing singers, you know, look like members of another Supremes group and utterly fantastic. But what a story it was, because Mary Wilson, in some of the reports I've read of her tragic death, was actually the better singer. But because Diana Ross had an affair at the age of about 19 with Berry Gordy, and they subsequently had a child together, because she was Berry Gordy's sort of, you know, girlfriend, she rose to prominence in the Supremes, and Berry Gordy even renamed the group Diana Ross and the Supremes. What a blow that would be for somebody who you'd started the group with.
Yeah, and she was always like that, I think, the pushy one, you know, and you see parodies of that group over the years, and you'd always have the sort of bigger one in the middle with the arms outstretched, pushing the other two, the other one being Florence Ballard, of course, originally, just pushing them out of the way and always pushing herself to the front. If you look at old footage, Diana Ross is always doing that, trying to outdo the other two. But Mary Wilson, I think, did have the better voice,
right,
and did have the most potential. She also had a share of very high-profile affairs, of course. Yes. Tom Jones having been the most famous one.
Yeah, Tom Jones. Apparently, she flew over to England to be with Tom Jones in Bournemouth, of all places. Tom Jones was appearing at, you know, some, I don't think it was the Bournemouth International Centre. That's a new building in Bournemouth, but it was something like that, a theatre in Bournemouth.
Winter Gardens.
Windsor Gardens, was it? Yeah, probably something like that. And Mary Olson flew over and stayed with him for a week. Tom Jones's wife, hello boyo, comes hurtling down from the valleys, hearing that, you know, Mary Wilson's in town, storms into this flat that they'd rented for him during the season in Bournemouth, and they managed to hide everything away that belonged to Mary Wilson, including Mary Wilson, who got out through, you know, some back door or something. But then Tom Jones's wife found a beautifully cooked joint in the oven, and knowing that Tom Jones couldn't cook, demanded to know who had cooked it, and then told Tom Jones that if she found out that this was another woman, she was going to castrate Tom Jones with the knife she was holding in her hand.
She was never going to leave him, and he was never going to leave her. They had an understanding in their marriage. He, you know, it's a very similar thing to what happened with John and Yoko when Yoko Ono couldn't cope with John's sex drive anymore and set him up with a mistress. And off he went to California with May Pang. Yes. It's a very similar thing. You know, it happens in marriages. The sex drive of the husband is intolerable to the wife. They don't want to break up because they're very happy together. So the wife turns a blind eye, but it's, I suppose it's the media who turns this into a circus and suggests that Linda comes screaming up from the valleys. I don't think it was anything like that, to be honest. She always knew what was going on with Tom and his women.
Yeah, well, the turn a blind eye thing, you're absolutely right. That has to happen. Otherwise, every marriage in, or at least half the marriage in the world would fall apart, wouldn't they? Now, Miss Jones, I know you're not a great television watcher, but have you been watching Bridgerton on Netflix?
No.
Right. Well, apparently this has now become the most successful Netflix series ever, which makes it one of the most successful TV programmes ever, okay? And it's all Regency stuff. There's a lot of bodice ripping and a lot of, you know, horizontal refreshment going on right the way through it. I watched about the first 5 minutes and I thought, this is not for me. It's definitely for women. You know what I mean? It's all about, you know, women fainting, you know, in the face of, you know, very handsome men riding around on big horses. I like to see Poldark and that series, but I can't stand this one. It's too mushy, lovey stuff, you know what I mean? However, the reason I'm telling you all this is that I was watching an interview this morning with the leading actress, and I thought, I'm sure I recognise that voice. I had my back to the television. I turned round, I thought, I'm sure I recognise that face. Anyway, I checked it out, and a lady called Adjoa Ando, right, has become the most famous actress in the world because she's the leading light of Bridgeport. And looking back, I did a Jeremy Vine on Five show with her last November. And I remember her now sitting next to her and talking to her and thinking, and by that time they'd made this series, but it hadn't been released, you see. So she was hardly known then. I mean, not being rude to Jo, she's famous enough actress who's been in a lot of character stuff in this country, but she's now the world's most famous. So that begs the question, Miss Jones, why didn't she recommend me as her leading man?
Well, that is the question I would be asking now. You know, she'd hot foot it to her management and find out what exactly happened there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they'd made the first series of Netflix, but they're now making the second. And I thought, well, between the first and the second, she's met me, she's worked alongside me, she's realised how smart I am, she's realised how cute I am, she's realised how attractive I am to the opposite sex, but I still haven't got the call. I just
don't. You weren't wearing a tie, pointing to your assets?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Well, of course, I don't have to wear a tie to point to my assets, do I? Oh, I'm sorry, this is a family show, isn't it? I shouldn't have said that.
I don't really go along with all that sort of bodice ripping stuff. It's to me, it's porn by another name. I don't want to watch it. You know, it's
It turned me off. And funny enough, I was reading Piers's column, and he said exactly the same. He and his wife Celia Walden, who we both know, another great Fleet Street journalist, columnist in the Telegraph. He said they sat down for it, and after 5 minutes, just realised it just what. Well, I don't know what Celia said, but Piers said, I just got up and walked out. It wasn't for me. And that was exactly the same with me. You know, a lot of giggling and laughing and innuendo and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? So it wasn't for
Italian
me.
Suppositories.
Italian suppositories. I'll gloss over that one, Miss Jones. I don't quite.
Innuendo.
I goodness, now I am so stupid. Listen, I know it's not your era of when you were the rock chick writer extraordinaire on the road all the time. But are the Foo Fighters any good?
Yeah, fantastic.
Right.
Absolutely wonderful band, yeah. They were founded by a guy called Dave Grohl,
right.
Who is a legend in the music industry because he's one of these multi-instrumentalists.
Yeah.
He's a singer, he's a songwriter, he writes and performs with all kinds of other artists as well.
Right.
He was the drummer in Nirvana, which you probably remember from way back.
Who was the drummer in Nirvana?
Dave Grohl.
Oh, I thought he was like a guitarist and songwriter.
Yeah, he's all that as well the Foo Fighters.
Right.
But he dates back to Nirvana in the early days. But you've heard, I mean, you must have heard their songs. Everlong, you would have heard Times Like These, Best of You.
Maybe, but I don't recognise song titles until I hear the song, you know what I mean? I think, oh, that's good. I wonder who sang that. Talking about that, I should have given our audience a rendition of my favourite Supreme song, which goes like this. Up the ladder to the roof. Where you can see heaven much better. I love that one, didn't you?
It's interesting about their songs because they pretty much all had the word love in them, or lots of them did. You Can't Hurry Love, Where Did Our Love Go, Stone Love, Baby Love, I'm Going to Make You Love Me.
Yeah.
It was
Dozier
Holland Dozier wrote all their songs, I think, wasn't it?
Was it Holland Dozier Holland or Dozier Holland Dozier?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah,
anyway, a few Hollands and a few Doziers.
That's right. Who incidentally, left Tamla Motown when Berry Gordy wouldn't give them a modest pay rise for writing, like, you know, 20 number one hits or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, wasn't it like that in those days?
Yes, of course it was. Anyway, back on to Supremes. Getting back onto the Foo Fighters, sorry. So what do they sound like then? What would I link them to? Oasis, the Beatles? What would... Because that's my sort of sound.
Quite heavy, quite metally.
Yeah.
Quite rocky, you know. It's not a light listen, but very catchy stuff. You know, it's not pop, I would say.
Oh, okay.
It's more in the rock vein. Go and have a listen.
I still haven't listened to Egypt Station because I just haven't had time. No, I just haven't.
I know you must make time. You must drive in your car somewhere.
Yeah, good idea.
And put that on in the car and just give yourself a couple of hours driving around listening to it. That's the way to experience it.
Yeah, but I might crash my car then. I like Mr. McCartney so much. What I'll do is I'll lie back on the couch, right, when I get a moment, put it on, and then just sort of close my eyes and let it absorb into my brain. You know what I mean?
You're such a busy man these days, Mr. Parry, that don't have time to relax.
Well, I'm not claiming that. Obviously, we're all very busy and we have to, you know, keep going in lockdown. It's not that I'm saying, oh, I'm so perpetually busy. It's finding a complete hour and a half to listen to it. You see what I mean? Without having to reply to an email or a text or answer the phone or pick up on something that somebody's asked you to sort out. You know what I mean? It's just that, really. But I know you know what I mean. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. And I'm delighted to say that Miss Jones is in top form. Now, Miss Jones, I've told you already at the start of this, I was feeling very good because of a great result by my football team, Everton. But I have another reason to start feeling good. And that is that at about 11 o'clock yesterday morning, I received a phone call. And I was asked if I would like my jab, the COVID vaccine. And of course, I said yes. And so I'm going today at 2 o'clock to get my jab. And I'm thrilled about it, but I'm a little mystified. Can you tell me how your mother received notification of her jab, please?
Yes, she got a letter both times from the NHS.
Right. OK. So what happened to me was the phone rang and it said private number on my phone. And of course, you don't always answer those, do you? You're not sure who's ringing. Sometimes a mobile phone number comes up and I answer them because it could be like a researcher on some show I'm working on who I haven't sort of dealt with before. So it's a new number. You know what I mean? But as long as there's a number there, it's fine. But I answered the phone and a very well-spoken woman said, hello, is that Michael Parry? And I said, yes. She said, hello, it's the surgery. I said, right. She said, we want to know whether you'd like to take your COVID vaccination jab. We have a space at 2 o'clock. on the said day. And I said, that's brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. She said, okay, so you sure you can make it? We don't want anybody to, you know, miss their slot. I said, no, that'd be great. Thank you very much indeed. And I said, right, that's great. I'll see you 2 o'clock. But I haven't had a text to follow that up. And normally speaking, when I deal with my surgery and on anything, you, a text immediately saying, don't forget your appointment or something like this. And I'm,
well, where have they told you to go?
To my local surgery.
Right. So have you tried ringing the surgery and, well, that's cross-checking it with them?
Well, that's going to be my next move, obviously, because now that I've thought it through and talked to you about it, I haven't had a letter. And the strangest thing is, well, it's not strange, it could be a different procedure. When I went up to Epsom Racecourse to try and see if I could get a spare one that had not been used that day, it was made very clear to me that nobody enters the premises without a letter, let alone getting a jab without an invitation, that you have to actually receive an invitation to get your jab. Now, I don't know if I've received that invitation. So you're absolutely right. First thing I'm going to do when we've finished recording this is I am going to ring the surgery and make sure it's not a scam. That'd be awful if, I mean, look, I'm not suggesting for a moment it is, but the procedure doesn't fit in line with the procedures I'm normally used to.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody is going to get a letter, because now that they've announced that the over 70s, anyone over 70 who hasn't yet been vaccinated should get in touch with the NHS themselves.
Yes,
that doesn't involve a letter, does it? So
yeah,
it could be that as time's ticking on, they're finding other ways around delivering this to as many people as possible, that they're changing the rules a little bit. But, you know, what would be in it for the scammer if you went to your surgery and didn't get a vaccination because they didn't have one for you?
Oh, just because some people are sick in the head, you know, and they would do those sort of things, wouldn't they? You know what I mean? Cause a national panic. But anyway, look, I mustn't start thinking like that. But I'm so, you know, thrilled that I've got it a little bit ahead of time, probably because of my dicky heart, that, you know, I don't want to be disappointed. But you're right, I will check it out. Talking about letters, have you had any problems with letters being received or that you've sent or that you're expecting in the last month or so?
Well, longer ago than that, since last March, when my sister, who lives in Norfolk, made us 12 handmade, properly wired, looped on the ears and all that masks for the pandemic.
Right.
So there are four of us. So she made us three each, one on, one off, one in the wash.
Yeah.
And she posted this package. It never arrived. It never has arrived. After about 6 weeks, she was so upset that we hadn't had them that she made another set.
Right.
So she spent all that time hand sewing all these things again, sent those, which arrived about 3 weeks later.
Solid.
And then we had things like, my birthday is in September. I didn't get all my birthday cards. They all arrived on the same day, the first week of December.
Right.
So we've had awful trouble with our mail in London. And I think it's to do with the fact that the our local sorting office is in Peckham.
Right.
And there's a very high BAME community in Peckham, and they seem to be more susceptible to the virus than maybe white people, for want of a better word.
Yes.
So there's a lot of time off being taken. There's a lot of illness down there. They are understaffed. And I think the mail is going missing.
Yeah. Well, something's definitely happening, because I've read a report just this very morning saying that 2 million people in this country have not received one letter for a month. Nothing. Nothing has been posted through their letterbox for a month. Now, I'm down in Stockbroker Vault, Surrey, and I seem to be doing okay. But if you don't pay your monthly credit card bills, in the old days, they just used to, you know, fine you £6 or something like that in interest or something like that. Now, they just completely close your card down if it hasn't reached them by the said date. That's happened to me twice in the last 4 months. You know, I've just gone to use my card and it's been rejected. And I say, well, that can't be so. There's nothing wrong with this card. And then ringing them up, found out, well, you haven't paid. And on both times, the check has disappeared. So I think I'm going to have to go and start paying online every month now, just to make sure it gets there.
You still pay your credit card bills by check?
Yes, I do, yes, because I like to know what I'm paying. I know it should be direct debit and all that, but then you can easily lose track of what you're... Almost everything that I spend now is on my credit cards. So when the credit card bill comes in, I can see exactly what I've spent and there's no hidden extras and all that kind of stuff. But you are right, it's antiquated, and I should... I should change it. The other thing, of course, which I can remember, I've just been talking to you about Egypt Station. I think you sent me that for my birthday, which is on the 29th of December. And I don't think I got it until about the 20th of January, did I?
That's right. Your birthday card was in with that as well. Yeah. You didn't get either of them until, well into January, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. So it does show that the postal service in this country is creaking at the seams, to say the least. Particularly if, I wonder where those letters that should have gone to the 2 million people who haven't got them, I wonder where they are now. And by the way, some could be invitations to go and get the COVID or something, you know?
Well, exactly. But
worrying, isn't it?
I think, in a time like this, the postal system should be more efficient because it's one of the few ways that we have of communicating with people properly.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Now, Ms. Jones, your father, of course, the legendary sports reporter Ken Jones, and a friend, or certainly a sporting acquaintance of Muhammad Ali. Do you ever remember him talking to you about the Lee and Spinks fight?
Oh, yeah, very much. That was in Las Vegas in 78.
Yeah.
The beginning of 78. Yeah, he was, it was the undisputed heavyweight championship, wasn't it?
Yes.
And Spinks, I think, was an Olympic gold medalist.
That's right.
The only man.
Age 22, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. The only man ever to take a world title away from Ali in the ring.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And at 22. Ali was, he hadn't trained properly, which is strange for him because he always took his sport so seriously. But Spinks was such an underdog, he didn't really think he needed to. And yet he beat him on points over 15 rounds. So it was because Spinks had trained extra hard, and Ali was slightly out of shape. He won it back, of course, in the rematch. I think that was 7 months later. But the reason I'm
September,
telling
you...
Sorry?
That was in September, the rematch.
That's right, yeah, but the reason I'm telling you all this is because, sadly, Leon Spinks has died at quite a young age. I think, was he about 60 or something? I think so. And the reason why he obviously became famous because he beat Muhammad Ali and he was world champion and all that, but then he lost everything almost as soon as he gained it. But the last job he had, believe it or not, was as a resident drinker in a bar in Detroit outside, we've just been talking about Detroit, haven't we, from Tamla Motown, but outside the gates of the Ford plant. And the idea was that the workers after work would go into this bar because Leon Spinks was there and buy a drink and chat with Leon Spinks. That was his job. That was his job towards the end of his life. And yeah, it just shows you how the world of boxing can one minute put you on literally on top of the world, and the next minute, you're in the gutter.
Well, and we all had to watch the demise of Muhammad Ali himself, didn't we?
Well, that was a physical thing, of course. That wasn't lifestyle.
Wasn't it awful? Yes. No, but it was awful. And it was lifestyle, really, because it was the choice he made to fight himself to death, pretty much.
Well, yes, everybody said he went on too long and received too many blows to the head. But what I'm saying...
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yes, of course you do. But what I'm saying is, Leon Spinks just took the usual routes to oblivion. Drink, drugs, loose women... ridiculously poor investments, people ripping him off. I mean, it's a classic tale of the way boxers come to a grisly end. Do you know what I mean?
Because they generally haven't had the benefit of education early in their life.
Yeah.
And they've gone down the route. There are a lot of sharks in the boxing
industry. Oh, yes, of course there are.
The fight game, as they call it. I mean, it's a classic euphemism, isn't it? The fight game.
Yes.
Because it attracts the lowest of the low life, and these people are exploited beyond all understanding.
Yeah.
And so many of them do end up the way of Leon Spinks.
Right. Actually, he was a bit older. He was born on July the 11th, 1953. He died February 6, 2021. So that's 47 plus 21. So he's 68. He was 68. So still not old, is it, for most people these days? Did your dad ever introduce you or talk to you about Johnny Conte?
I met John Conte a few times, actually.
Oh, good, because I think he's a great guy. Yeah, go on. Ooh. Yeah. Wasn't he a smashing bloke?
Didn't he have a bar in just behind Selfridges at one point, and it was called JC's? And didn't you go to the launch of that? I went to the launch of that. And they invited a load of people on launch night whose initials were also JC.
Oh,
so
really?
People like Joan Collins and all kinds of guests who they had a special sort of invitation because they had the same initials as him. Jesus didn't rock up, but he wasn't available that night.
That's right, yeah. Oh, no, I love John Conte. The last time I saw John Conte, he was at Harefield Hospital with me. I go every year. They have a 1 kilometer walk or run or whatever for heart patients, you know, and I usually host it and all that kind of stuff because I'm still an outpatient at Harefield because, of course, only 1/3 of my heart works, right? But John Conte was there because a relative of his and his family, couldn't quite work out who it was, had also had treatment at Harefield. And John lives somewhere like Hertfordshire, you know, like Watford or somewhere around there or something. But, you know, he was a hero of mine because I remember we went to Goodison Park one night on a Wednesday to watch Everton. And as soon as it finished, everybody piled into the pubs because John Conte was fighting that night. It wasn't at the Liverpool Stadium where he won his world title, but he was fighting somewhere else. And we all piled into the pubs and whoever he was fighting, he beat anyway. And I only met him years later. The first time I met him, he was having problems because he had a similar problem at the end of his career. You know, bad investments, lost his money, all that kind of stuff. And I had to go and see him. And it was terrifying because he was in a very bad mood. And if you ever knock on the door of a boxer who's been the world light heavyweight champion and he's not very happy with you, it is a very frightening prospect, believe me.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Isn't he one of the figures on the cover of the band On the Run album?
Yes, he is. It's Kenny Lynch, isn't it?
Okay, is that Kenny Lynch?
Kenny Lynch,
okay.
Yeah, it's not John Conte.
I remembered that incorrectly. I thought it was him. I thought he was
Although he would have been perfect, because, of course, he's a Liverpool boy like the Beatles and like McCartney. But a terribly nice man. When I last met him, he got over all his problems years ago, and he makes a very decent living now just doing, he won't be at the moment, but doing boxing dinners and appearances and all that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, there we are. Now, I want to talk to you about Westlife, Miss Jones. They seem to have now completely disappeared off the face of the pop historical earth because their contracts have been cancelled. They were the first of the boy bands, weren't they, who rose to great heights, but now seem to have slipped into oblivion.
No, they haven't at all. They were due out on the road for a massive comeback tour in 2020, it is going to happen. But they have parted company with EMI, who were themselves subject to a big relaunch because EMI had faded into oblivion over the last few years. And they had a big comeback last year. It was a big rebirth of the flagship UK label, officially the number one record company now, because of course they've got Lewis Capaldi, they've got Queen with Adam Lambert, they've got Taylor Swift, Paul McCartney, all these kinds of people. But Westlife and EMI have parted company.
Right,
and Westlife are about to announce their new global partnership with another label.
Yeah.
And they're going out on a massive global tour as soon as the pandemic lifts. So I don't think we've seen the last of them by any means.
So you think people will go and watch them? Yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think they've got... I mean, their fan base is obviously, I would say, about 50% retrospective because a lot of young girls grew up on the music of Westlife.
Yeah.
You're going to sing us a song now, aren't you?
No, because I don't know any Westlife songs. Seriously, I don't know any. I wouldn't recognise one. To me, they're just, I'm not being dismissive, but they're just a bunch of singers. I read an interview with Gary...
Well, isn't that what most bands are?
Well, no, most bands play instruments, write songs and know something about, you know, the composition of the music they're singing. But I don't think Westlife write songs, do they?
I think they probably do.
Probably
you must know some of their hits. You must know Flying Without Wings, You Raise Me Up.
No, I don't know.
Seasons in the Sun. Who did that originally?
Oh, no, that's from the 70s.
They did a cover of it.
We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. And it's about some bloke who's dying of cancer, sadly, and he's talking to his little boy, you know. Sad song.
Yeah, I know the song. Yeah, it is. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with cover versions. So many bands do cover versions. You know, it's not a big deal.
I read an interview with Gary Barlow in one of last weekend's Colour magazines. You may have seen it yourself. And, you know, he talked about the crisis at the end of Take That because, what's his name? Robbie Williams. I mean, soared off into global fame as a solo singer, you know, and was, you know, starring, you know, headlines everywhere. And Gary Barlow just sunk into despair, even though Gary Barlow, most people would say, is 10 times more talented, isn't he, than Robbie Williams.
I never got the appeal of Robbie Williams. I'm sorry. I think the last time I saw him, I happened to walk in the room when somebody was watching Strictly. Yeah. Robbie Williams was performing live on Strictly. And I sat down for a minute thinking, I need to understand why this works. Yes. What is it about this guy?
Yes.
And I thought, he's an all right singer. He's a bit gauche, a bit awkward on the stage. He's not that attractive, frankly. Yeah. He doesn't tower over everybody else. What is it about him? I just couldn't get why he's become such a superstar.
No, I totally agree. I don't know what differentiates him from a pub singer in, you know, a local theatre or something like that. But look, that sounds miserable and mean. He's had tremendous success, and I like successful people because they are winners. I've read a report, Ms. Jones, that says that overweight, that is flab, now kills more Britons than smoking. Now, do you believe that, or is that just another health scare from, you know, the do-gooders?
Actually, I do believe it, because the figures yell it from the rooftops, don't they? I think obesity is killing people, and it's one of those stealth killers as well. Mm. It's been creeping up on people. You know, you don't notice yourself getting fat, do you? You maybe get a bit lazy about your eating. But you don't notice it happen overnight.
No, over the decades, I agree. Everybody.
It creeps up, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
The same as alcoholism creeps up. You don't go from being a non-alcoholic yesterday to being dependent on booze today.
No.
So it sort of creeps up and takes over your life.
Yes.
I guess.
Yes.
People get lazy about their eating habits, and they open the fridge and eat whatever falls out. They resort to the cakes and the chocolates, especially at this time, while we're under so much stress from the pandemic and so on. I think there a lot of people have put weight on during the lockdowns.
So
we should all be, I guess, eating less, eating more sensibly and exercising more.
Yes, I agree. I suppose you could say it's the hidden killer, because, as you quite rightly say, it comes on in such a sort of comes on like the tide coming in very slowly, so to speak. But I would say that if you're smoking cigarettes, you are more deliberately harming yourself than you are just from overeating, wouldn't you?
Well, no, not necessarily, because, you know, especially a lot of people would say, well, I'm not fat, I can still fit into my size 12 jeans or whatever. But the problem is the hidden fat. It's the fat that's collecting around the internal organs, and that we can't see. And that's what we have to be careful about, because your heart will give out if it's carrying a lot of that dangerous fat gathered around it that you can't tell is there.
Thank you for the medical lesson, Miss Jones.
That's okay.
I remember actually talking about lung cancer, very sadly. Your dad will also have known a guy called Joe Melling, right? Do you recognise
that
name?
No, not at all.
Joe Melling was the chief soccer writer on the Daily Express. Then he got a very good offer to go to the Mail on Sunday when the Mail on Sunday opened. So that's a few years ago now, isn't it? And he went over there, but, like him, I could never work on a Sunday newspaper because I don't know what I'd do for the rest of the week. And Joe found that inhibiting. But anyway, nevertheless, he was, you know, he was at the top of his tree. And then all of a sudden he was admitted to hospital, the London Hospital. Is that the one on Oxford Street? There's a London Clinic or something, is it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I thought it was near London Bridge, the London Hospital.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think it is. I think you're right. Anyway, point is, all of a sudden he was diagnosed with lung cancer. And Joe always spoke like this. Joe was a northern lad from Manchester. And he always had a voice like this because he'd been smoking since he was 14, you know. And we went to see him, and around his bedside, it was obvious he was so terribly ill. But it was about 3 months before the European Championships in 2004, which were in Portugal, right? And we were all going to those. And Joe was saying, all right, lads. The doctors have told me, I'm on the road to recovery. I'm going to be out of here in a month's time. I want you to book this restaurant in Lisbon and that restaurant down on the Algarve. We're going to be, don't forget to take your clubs, lads. We'll have a few rounds of golf. And he died a month later. And it was so sad to see that sort of, well, I suppose it wasn't sad, really. I suppose it was quite nice that he was still so hopeful about his life, you know.
Well, this is what people do at the end of their lives. You know, they rally. They're a bit in denial. They don't accept that this is the end. Mm. And they want to make plans, because to have something to look forward to is a way of surviving.
Yes, I suppose you're absolutely right. You've got to be optimistic or else it would all be
it's
over.
It's the end. I like the accent, by the way. You remind me of some comedian who I know is so familiar to me from the TV screen and so on. I can't think of his name.
He talks like this, like a northern lad who talks like that. Bobby Ball died, didn't Bobby Ball.
Yeah, no, it's not him. It's a sort of larger kind of guy, dark hair. Can't think of his name. It'll come to me.
Yeah, it will come to you. Now, you've brought up three children. You've had students in your family for such a long time. Eight students have been fined £800 each for gathering in a common room at Manchester University during proactive patrols in the Owen Park halls of residence. Police found 25 students in the same room and they fined them all £800. Where's a student going to get £800 from?
The Bank of Mum and Dad.
Yeah, but to pay a fine because they just happen to be in the same room as other students. How ridiculous is that?
I agree. It is against the rules. Hmm. I think rather than fine them, they should have helped them to understand why it's a dangerous thing to do that at the moment and why they're putting themselves at risk. But my question about these fines is always, where does that money go? Who benefits from that money? Yes. I bet they're not giving it to charity.
No, of course not.
So I bet, I've some idea of a bunch of teachers all going out on the Raz. Of course, none of us can go out on the Raz at the moment because everything's closed down. But where does the fine money go?
No, I totally agree. It says here the students are in 14-person bubbles, but in their defence said the common room was the only place to sit with flatmates other than bedrooms and the canteen, and mingling was unavoidable. I think the whole system's a mess. And look, you expect it to be a mess. It's something we've never coped with before. So I think we have to make it up as we go along, really, don't you?
Yeah, we do. And I feel so damn sorry for these students.
So do I. I'm
thrilled for my own guys that they managed to get through the bulk of their courses and have not had to do their lessons online and that kind of thing. They had the proper university experience. They all did.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm so sorry for all of those students who are not having a proper all-round university thrill.
Experience.
It's such a special time of
your
life.
Of course it is,
It's going to be ruined for them for the rest of their lives. I am so sorry about that.
Yeah, so am I. And the amazing thing is, my family down in Bournemouth are involved in, you know, the student letting industry. A lot of people down there are because there's obviously a big demand for it. I think they've got the biggest media faculty in the country. And do you know what? There is a huge demand for student accommodation from September this year. And the industry thought, well, that'll all drop off. People will now give up, go to university. The reverse has happened. You know, kids now want a proper, as you quite rightly say, university experience. And many have signed up for a repeat year. And many more want to get, because remember, if they're not in halls of residence, they're locked up at home and want to get out, you see.
Well, lots of them aren't. And the thing I've found really disgusting, and the government does need to do something about this, is those students who have gone home and have been doing their lessons online, their lectures and their tutorials and so on, online. Yeah. Yeah. So they've left behind rental flats that they're no longer living in.
Yes.
But those students have been held to paying the rent on those rental flats for entire years because they signed contracts and they've still had to carry on paying the money. Now, there's something very wrong about that arrangement.
Well,
and I really feel Boris needs to address that.
Well, let me tell you, student accommodation in halls of residence at universities has been, in my view, a racket for years. The government have handed out contracts to huge international building companies to build towers and towers of student accommodation. And you're quite right. You have to sign up for the whole year. And that's your bit of space. And I'm sorry if you don't want to use it. That's, you know, the attitude is, well, that's your fault, not ours. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I'm not talking about the student accommodation. I'm talking about, you know, you do your first year in Hall of Residence, which is what everybody does.
Yes.
Then they go out into the field, into the public sector, and they rent private flats. And those landlords are holding them to ransom. I think it's a disgrace and something needs to be done about it.
Well, it's something that's got to be looked at along with all of the other problems. But anyway, let's hope that the sun is coming over the hill. Ms. Jones, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. And of course, I will keep you up to date with the jab. If I'm getting the jab later today, that will be a wonderful thing. You'll be the first to know. If not, and something's gone wrong, you'll also be the first to know. So expect a notification from me one way or the other a little later today, Miss Jones.
Yeah, good luck, Mike, and see you anon.
Thank you very much. And to everybody else, stay safe. We'll be back with you soon. He was in the pub there one time, and he started telling us all about a conquest he'd made on one of the Telyad girls, okay? And he didn't realise that some of the other Telyad girls were sitting there. So after about 10 minutes, all of a sudden the doors flung open. This girl comes storming in. I mean it, storming in. And what had happened was one of the Telyad girls already in the pub had gone back to the office and told her that this guy was telling a tale of an alleged sexual conquest involving her and telling it in dramatic detail. And this lady stormed in, confronted him, slapped him across the face, said if she ever heard anything like that being spoken about again involving her, she would go to lawyers and she would sue him, and that he was a pathetic little runt, and that, you know, he had about as much chance of indulging in a sexual liaison with her as nodding.
They were founded by a guy called Dave Grohl, right, who is a legend in the music industry because he's one of these multi-instrumentalists.
Yeah.
He's a singer, he's a songwriter, he writes and performs with all kinds of other artists as well.
Right.
He was the drummer in Nirvana, which you probably remember from way back.
Who was the drummer in Nirvana?
Dave Grohl.
Oh, I thought he was like a guitarist and songwriter. Either he's a very stupid man to propose to two, or he actually had honourable intentions to honour the two women, but couldn't remember which one. What a trip.